hands felt warm and tingly. The relief was almost unbearable. He did it again, and a few more sparks flew out, weaker this time. He watched them trail down around him. The third time he got only one. "What does it mean?" he asked. "I have no idea," Professor Sunderland said. "I'll put you down as undetermined. We'll try again next year."
"Next year?"
Quentin watched with a rising sense of disappointment as she jumped down off the table and started reopening shutters, window by window. He winced at the sunlight flooding in.
"What do you mean? What am I going to do till then?"
"Wait," she said.
"It happens. People put too much importance on these things. Be a darling and send in the next student, would you? We're already running late, and it's only noon."
The summer dragged by in slow motion. It was really the fall, of course, in the world outside Brakebills, and the Brooklyn Quentin came home to for summer vacation was chilly and gray, the streets plastered with wet brown leaves and mashed ginkgo balls that smelled like vomit. He haunted his old house like a ghost. It took a special effort to make himself visible to his parents, who always looked vaguely surprised when their phantom son requested their attention. James and Julia were away at college, so Quentin took long walks. He visited the branching, angular Gowanus Canal, its water the green of pooled radiator fluid. He shot baskets on deserted courts with missing nets and rainwater puddles in the corners. The autumn cold gave the ball a dead, inert feel. His world wasn't here. It was elsewhere. He traded desultory emails with friends from Brakebills, Alice, Elliot, Surendra, Gretchen, and flipped indifferently through his summer reading, an 18th-century history of magic that appeared quite slim from the outside, but turned out to contain, by some subtle bibliographical magic, no fewer than 1,832 pages. In November, he received a cream-colored envelope, which turned up tucked by invisible hands into History of Magic. It contained a stiff letterpressed card with an elegant engraving of the Brakebills crest, inviting him to return to school at 6 in the evening by way of a narrow, never-used alleyway next to the First Lutheran Church, 10 blocks from his house. He dutifully presented himself at the correct address at the appointed time. This late in the fall, the sun set at 4:30 in the afternoon, but it was unseasonably mild out, almost warm. Standing there at the entrance to the passageway, looking around for stray vergers who might charge him with trespassing, or worse, offer him spiritual guidance, cars whooshing by in the street behind him, he had never felt so absolutely sure that he was delusional, that Brooklyn was the only reality there was, and that everything which had happened to him last year was just a fanboy hallucination, proof that the boredom of the real world had finally driven him totally and irreversibly out of his mind. The alley was so skinny he practically had to turn sideways to walk down it. His two overstuffed Brakebills duffel bags, they were midnight blue with dark brown trim, school colors, scraping against the sweating stone walls on either side. He was overwhelmingly certain that in 30 seconds he would be standing at the blank wall at the end of the alley. But then an impossible breath of warm, sweet, late summer air came wafting toward him from the far end of the alleyway, accompanied by the chirping of crickets, and he could see the green expanse of the sea. As heavy as his bags were, he ran toward it. Now it was the first day of the semester, and Quentin and Alice were stranded in a baking hot meadow outside a precious white Victorian bungalow. The bungalow was where the students who did physical magic met on Tuesday afternoons for their weekly seminar. When she was tested, Alice displayed a highly technical discipline involving light manipulation, phosphoromancy, she said it was called, that placed her in physical magic. Quentin was there because physical was the group that had both the fewest total members and the fewest incoming members, so that seemed like the best place to stash him until he had a discipline of his own. The first seminar had been scheduled for 12:30, and Quentin and Alice
had even gotten there early, but now it was almost 5, and they'd been out there all afternoon. They were hot and tired and thirsty and annoyed, but neither of them wanted to give up and go back up to the house. If they were going to be physical kids, apparently they would have to prove it by getting in the front door. They sat under a massive spreading beech tree that stood nearby, coolly indifferent to their plight. They leaned back against the trunk with a fat, hard, gray root between them. "So what do you want to do?" Quentin said dully. Tiny motes drifted by in the late afternoon sunlight.
"I don't know."
Alice sneezed again.
"What do you want to do?"
Quentin plucked at the grass. A burst of faint laughter came from inside the house. If there was a password, they hadn't found it. He and Alice had spent an hour looking for hidden writing. They scanned the door in every spectrum they could think of, visible and invisible, infrared to gamma, and tried to strip the paint off to look underneath, but it wouldn't come. Alice even tried some advanced graphological enchantments on the squiggly grain of the wood itself, but it just stared back at them blankly. They'd sent currents of force twisting into the lock, jiggling the tumblers, but they couldn't pick it. They looked for a fourth-dimensional path around the door. They jointly plucked up their nerve and summoned a kind of phantasmal axe. It wasn't explicitly against any rule they could think of, but they couldn't even scratch it. For a while, Alice was convinced the door was an illusion, that it didn't even exist, but it certainly looked and felt real, and neither of them could find any charms or enchantments to dispel.
"Look at it," Quentin said. "It's like some lame Hansel and Gretel hut. I thought the physical kids were supposed to be cool."
"Dinner's in an hour," Alice said.
"I'll skip it."
"It's lamb tonight with a rosemary crust. Potatoes au dauphin."
Alice's eidetic memory retained odd details.
"Maybe we should have our own seminar out here."
She snorted.
"Yeah, that'd show 'em."
The beech tree was on the edge of a field that had just been mown. The giant cinnamon rolls of hay dotting the field cast long shadows.
"You're a what again? A photomancer?"
"Phosphoromancer."
"What can you do?"
"I'm not sure yet. I practiced some things over the summer, focusing light, refracting it, bending it. If you bend light around something, it turns invisible. But I want to understand the theory of it first."
"Show me something." Alice turned shy. It didn't take much.
"I can hardly do anything. Look, I don't even have a discipline. I'm a nothing-mancer. I'm a squat-mancer."
"They just don't know what it is yet. You have your little sparky thing."
"Same difference. And don't make fun of my sparky thing. Now bend me some damn light."
She grimaced, but she got up on her knees on the grass and held up her hand, fingers spread. They were kneeling face to face, and he was suddenly aware of her full breasts inside her thin, high-necked blouse.
"Watch the shadow," she snapped.
She did something with her fingers, and the shadow of her hand disappeared. It was simply gone, leaving behind only a few ghostly rainbow highlights.
"Nice."
"It's pathetic, I know."
She waved her hand, scrubbing out the magic.
"My whole hand is supposed to go invisible, but I can only do the shadow."
There was something here. Quentin felt his sulk starting to dispel. This was a test. Physical magic. They weren't Morris dancing with tree spirits here. This was a brute force problem.
"What about the other way?" he said slowly. "Could you focus light instead, like a magnifying glass?"
She didn't answer right away, but he could see her nimble mind take hold of the problem and start turning it over.
"Maybe if I... I think there's something in Cullich and Owen. You'd need to stabilize the effect, though, and localize it."
She made a circle with her thumb and forefinger and spoke 5 long words over it.
Quentin could see light bending inside the circle, warping and distorting the leaves and grass visible through it. Then it sharpened and focused to a white dot that burned an afterimage into his retina, and he looked away. She tilted it, and the ground under her hand smoked.
"I will kill you if you get me kicked out of Brakebills. Do you understand me? I'm not joking. I know how to do it. I will literally make you die."
"That's funny. That's exactly what I told Penny after he hit me," Quentin said. "Except I'll really do it." They had decided to burn their way through the door. If it was a test, Quentin reasoned, it didn't matter much how they solved it, as long as they solved it. They hadn't been given any rules, so they couldn't be breaking any. And if they did burn down the damn house with Elliot and his smug little friends inside it, serve them right. They had to work fast because the sunlight was fading. The sun had already gone dull and coppery, and in another few minutes its lower rim would touch the tops of the trees on the far side of the hayfield. The barest early fall chill was in the air. Yellow lights were already on inside the house. Quentin heard, did he imagine it? The pop of a cork being withdrawn from a bottle. Holding both arms above her head and curved slightly upward, like she was balancing a large invisible basket on her head, Alice had created the magical equivalent of a magnifying glass a dozen yards across. Her bent arms defined a small section of the total circumference of a soaring, circular lens, the upper edge of which was even with the top of the beech tree, taller than the chimney of the little Victorian bungalow. Quentin could just make out the edge of the lens as a curved distortion in the air. The focal point was too bright to look at. Alice stood about 50 feet back from the door. Quentin stood closer to one side, holding out a hand to shield his eyes and shouting out directions.
Up! Okay, slow! A little more! Keep moving! Okay, now right!
Quentin could feel the heat from the focused sunlight against his face and smell the savory sweet smell of wood smoke along with an acrid tang of seared house paint. The door was definitely vulnerable to heat. They'd been worried that there wouldn't be enough sunlight left, but Alice's spell was cutting a nice, deep, charred trench in the wood. They decided to cut the door in half, laterally, and if the trench wasn't penetrating all the way through, it must be pretty close. A bigger problem was Alice's aim, which wasn't good, and in one place she had wandered off the door and burned a groove in the wall.
"I feel stupid," Alice shouted. "How are we doing?"
"Looking good."
"My back hurts. Are we almost done?"
"Almost," he lied.
With a foot to go, Alice expanded the spell's radius to compensate for the fading sun. She was whispering, but he wasn't sure if it was an incantation or just obscenities. Quentin realized they were being observed. One of the older professors, a very erect, white-haired man named Brzezinski, who specialized in potions and whose pants were always covered with appalling stains, had interrupted his evening stroll to watch them. In another lifetime, he had given Quentin the tests involving knots during his examination. He wore sweater vests and smoked a pipe and looked like an IBM engineer circa 1950. Shit, Quentin thought. They were about to get busted. But Professor Brzezinski just took his pipe out of his mouth.
"Get on," he said gruffly.
He turned and walked back in the direction of the house. It took only about 10 minutes for Alice to make a full lateral cut, then go back across it a second time. The trench glowed red. When she was finished, Quentin walked back to where she was standing.
"You have ash on your face," she said.
She brushed at his forehead with her fingers.
"Maybe we should go across again, you know, just to be sure."
If this didn't work, he was out of ideas, and he didn't think he could spend the night out here. He also didn't think he could face going back to the house in defeat.
"There's not enough light."
She looked drained.
"By the end, the lens was probably out to a quarter mile. After that, it just loses coherence, falls apart at the edges."
A quarter mile? Quentin thought. How powerful is she?
His stomach rumbled. It was fully dusk now, and the sky was a luminous blue. They stared at the scarred, blackened door. It looked worse than he thought. Alice's aim had strayed on the second pass, so in places there were two separate trenches. If this was wrong, Elliot was going to kill him.
Should I try to kick it in?
Alice pulled her mouth to one side.
What if there's somebody behind it?
So what do you suggest?
I don't know.
She picked at one of the burnt parts that had cooled.
I think we're almost through.
There was an old iron knocker on the door in the shape of a disembodied hand holding an iron ball. It was bolted on.
Okay, Quentin said. Stand back. God, please let this work.
He got a good grip on the iron hand, put one foot on the door, uttered a long falsetto martial arts yell, and threw his weight backward. The top half of the door swung open with no resistance whatsoever. It must have been hanging on by a few flakes of ash. He fell down backward on the path. A girl Quentin recognized as one of the fourth years stood in the doorway with warm light streaming out into the twilight around her, holding a glass of dark red wine in one hand. She looked down at him coolly. Alice was leaning against the side of the house, laughing so hard that no sound was coming out.
"Dinner's almost ready," the girl said. "Elliot made an amatriciana sauce. We couldn't get any guanciale, but I think bacon works fine. Don't you?"
In spite of the heat, a fire popped and flickered in the fireplace.
6 hours, 12 minutes, said a fat young man with wavy hair sitting in a leather club chair. That's actually about par.
Tell them how long it took you, Josh, said the girl who'd met them at the door. Quentin thought her name was Janet.
20 hours, 31 minutes. Longest night of my life. Not a record, but pretty close.
We thought he was trying to starve us out. Janet poured out the rest of a bottle of red wine into two glasses standing on a sideboard and handed them to Quentin and Alice. Two more empty bottles stood on the floor, though the others didn't seem especially drunk. They were in a shabby but comfortable library lined with threadbare rugs and lit by candles and firelight. Quentin realized that the little house must be larger on the inside than it was on the outside. It was also a lot cooler. The atmosphere was that of a nice, chilly fall evening. Books overflowed the bookcases and stood in wobbly stacks in the corners and even on the mantelpiece. The furniture was distinguished but mismatched, and in places it was severely battered. In between the bookcases, the walls were hung with the usual inexplicable artifacts that accumulate in private clubs: African masks, dreary landscape paintings, retired ceremonial daggers, glass cases full of maps and medals, and the deteriorating corpses of exotic moths that had presumably been captured at great effort and expense. Quentin felt overheated and underdressed, but mostly just relieved to finally be inside. There were only 5 of them, counting himself and Alice. Elliot was there, scanning one of the bookshelves and acting like he hadn't noticed them yet. He seemed to be trying to make a serious argument about magical theory to somebody, but nobody was listening.
"Tinkerbell, we have guests," Janet said. "Please turn around and face the room."
She was lean and animated, with a serious, somewhat anachronistic pageboy haircut. She was the loud one. Quentin had seen her holding forth to the others on walks through the maze and making speeches over dinner in the dining room. Elliot broke off his monologue and turned around. He was wearing an apron.
"Hello," he said, not missing a beat. "Glad you could make it. Alice, I understand you burned our door in half."
"Quentin helped."
"We watched you out the window," Josh said. "You're hella lucky Brzezinski didn't catch you with that axe."
"What's the correct solution?" Alice asked. "I mean, I know it worked, but there must be a better way."
She took a timid sip of her wine, immediately followed by a less timid one.
"There isn't one," Janet said. "Or not a good one, anyway. That's part of the point. This is physical magic. It's messy. It's crude. As long as you don't knock the building down, it counts. And if you did, it would probably still count."
"How did you do it?" Alice asked shyly. "I mean, when it was your turn."
"Froze and shattered it. I do a special kind of cold magic. That's my discipline. 63 minutes. And that is a record."
"It used to be you could say friend in Elvish and it would let you in," Joss said. "Now too many people have read Tolkien."
"Elliot, darling, I think our dinner must be ready," Janet said. Her attitude toward Elliot was hard to read, a weird combination of tenderness and contempt. She clapped her hands. "Josh, maybe you could do something about..."
She gestured in the direction of the half-demolished door.
"The mosquitoes are getting in."
Still dazed, Quentin trailed Elliot into the kitchen, which was again larger and nicer than really seemed plausible from the outside, with white cabinets up to the high ceiling and soapstone counters and an aerodynamic-looking 1950s refrigerator. Elliot sloshed some wine from his glass into a pan of red sauce on the stove.
"Never cook with a wine you wouldn't drink," he said, "though I guess that presupposes that there is a wine I wouldn't drink."
He didn't seem at all embarrassed by the fact that he'd ignored Quentin for the past year. It was like it never happened.
"So you have this whole place to yourself?"
Quentin didn't want to let on how much he wanted to belong here, even now that he did officially belong here.
"Pretty much. So do you now."
"Do all the disciplines have their own clubhouses?"
"It's not a clubhouse," Elliot said sharply.
He dumped a huge clump of fresh pasta into a tall pot of boiling water and stirred it to break it up.
"This'll cook in about a minute flat."
"Then what is it?"
"Well, all right, it is a clubhouse, but don't call it that. We call it the cottage. We have the seminars here, and the library isn't bad. Sometimes Janet paints in the bedroom upstairs. Only we can get in here, you know."
"What about Fogg?"
"Oh, and Fogg, though he never bothers. And Bigby. You know Bigby, right?"
Quentin shook his head.
"I can't believe you don't know Bigby," Elliot said, chuckling. "God, you're going to love Bigby."
He tasted the sauce, then glugged in a slug of heavy cream and stirred it in widening circles. The sauce paled and thickened. Elliot had a jaunty, off-handed confidence at the stove.
"All the groups have a place like this. The naturals have this deeply lame treehouse off in the forest. The illusionists have a house just like this one, though only they know where it is. You have to find it to get in. Knowledge just has the library, the poor suckers, and healing has the clinic." "Elliot!" Janet's voice came from the other room. "We're starving!"
Quentin wondered how Alice was faring out there.
"All right, all right.
I hope you don't mind pasta," he added to Quentin. "It's all I made.
There's bruschetta out there, or there was. At least there's lots of wine."
He drained the pasta in the sink, sending up a huge gout of steam, and dumped it into the pan to finish in the sauce.
"God, I love cooking. I think if I weren't a magician, I'd be a chef. It's just such a relief after all that invisible, intangible bullshit, don't you think?"
"Richard was the real cook around here. I don't know if you knew him. He graduated last year. Tall, total grind, made us all look bad in front of Bigby. But at least he could cook.
Grab those two bottles there, would you? And the corkscrew?"
With a white tablecloth and two heavy silver candelabras and a wildly eclectic assortment of silverware, some of which bordered on light hand-to-hand weaponry, the table in the library almost looked like somewhere you could eat. The food was simple, but not at all bad. He'd forgotten he was starving. Janet performed a trick. Quentin wasn't sure whether it was magical or just mechanical, to shorten the long seminar table into a dinner table. Janet, Josh, and Elliot gossiped about classes and teachers and who was sleeping with whom and who wanted to sleep with whom. They speculated endlessly about other students' relative strengths as spellcasters. They maneuvered around one another with the absolute confidence of people who had spent huge amounts of time together, who trusted and loved one another, and who knew how to show off one another to best advantage and how to curb each other's boring and annoying habits. Quentin let the chatter wash over him. Eating a sophisticated meal alone in their own private dining room felt very adult. This was it, he thought. He had been an outsider before, but now he had really entered into the inner life of the school. This was the real Brakebills. He was in the warm, secret heart of the secret world. They were arguing about what they would do after they graduated. I imagine I'll retreat to some lonely mountain top, Elliot said airily. Become a hermit for a while. I'll grow a long beard and people will come to me for advice, like in cartoons. Advice about what? Josh snorted. About whether a dark suit counts as black tie? And I'd like to see you try to grow a beard, Janet added. God, you're self-centered. Don't you want to help people? Elliot looked puzzled. People? What people? Poor people, hungry people, sick people, people who can't do magic. What have people ever done for me? People don't want my help. People called me a faggot and threw me in a dumpster at recess when I was in fifth grade because my pants were pressed. Well, I hope for your sake there's a wine cellar on your mountaintop, Janet said, annoyed, or a full bar. You won't last 8 hours without a drink. I will brew a crude but potent beverage from local herbs and berries. Or dry cleaning. Well, that is a problem. You can use magic, but it's never the same. Maybe I'll just live at the plaza, like Eloise. I'm bored, Josh bellowed. Let's do Harper's fire shaping. He went over to a large cabinet full of dozens of tiny drawers, narrow but deep, that turned out to be a kind of miniature twig library. Each drawer bore a tiny handwritten label, starting with Ailanthus in the upper left-hand corner and ending with Zelkova, Japanese, in the lower right. Harper's fire shaping was a useless but extremely entertaining spell for stretching and leading a flame into elaborate calligraphic shapes that flared for a moment in midair and then disappeared. You did it with an aspen twig. The evening devolved into attempts to shape the candle flames into increasingly elaborate or obscene words and shapes, which in turn led, inevitably, to the curtains catching on fire, apparently not for the first time, and having to be extinguished. A halt was called. Elliot produced a slender, dangerous-looking bottle of grappa. Only two of the candles had survived the fire shaping, but nobody bothered to replace the others. It was late, after 1 in the morning. They sat there in the half-darkness in contented silence. Janet lay on her back on the carpet, staring up at the ceiling, her feet propped up on Elliot's lap. There was a funny physical intimacy between the two of them, especially considering what Quentin knew about Elliot's sexual appetites.
So this is it? We're full-fledged physical kids now?
The grappa was like a fiery seed that had drifted into Quentin's chest and taken root there. The seed gave birth to a hot, glowing sapling which grew and spread and unfolded into a big, warm, leafy tree of good feeling.
Don't we have to be hazed or branded or, I don't know, shaved or something?
Not unless you want to be, Josh said.
Somehow I thought there would be more of you, Quentin said. Of us.
This is it, Elliot said. Since Richard and Isabel graduated, there aren't any fifth years. Nobody placed in. If we didn't get anybody this year, Fogg was talking about merging us with Natural.
Josh shuddered theatrically.
What were they like?
Alice asked. Richard and Isabel?
Like fire and ice, Josh said. Like chocolate and marzipan.
It's different without them, Elliot said.
Good riddance, said Janet.
Well, they weren't so bad, Josh said. You remember when Richard thought he could bring the weather vane to life? He was going to make it move around by itself. He must have been up there for 3 days rubbing it with fish oil, and I don't even want to think about what else.
That was unintentionally funny, Janet said. Doesn't count.
You just never got the point of Richard, Janet snorted.
I got plenty of Richard, she said, with surprising bitterness.
A tiny hush fell. It was the first false note of the evening.
But now we have a quorum again, Elliot said quickly, an eminently respectable quorum. Physical magic always gets the best ones.
To the best ones, Josh said.
Quentin raised his glass. He was up in the lofty branches of his fiery tree, swaying in the warm, alcoholic breeze.
The best ones.
They all drank. The Beast. The entire time he'd been at Breakbills, through first year, the exams, the whole disaster with Penny, right up until the night he joined the physical kids, Quentin had been holding his breath without knowing it. He realized only now that he'd been waiting for Breakbills to vanish around him like a daydream. Even aside from the many and varied laws of thermodynamics that were violated there on a regular basis, it was just too good to be true. It was like fillery that way. Fillery never lasted forever. Ember and Umber promptly kicked the Chatwins out at the end of every book. Deep down, Quentin felt like a tourist who at the end of the day would be herded back onto some dirty, lumbering, snorting tour bus with ripped vinyl seats and overhead TVs and a stinking toilet, and shipped home, clutching a tacky souvenir postcard and watching as the towers and hedges and peaks and gables of Breakbills dwindled in the rearview mirror. But it hadn't happened, and now he understood, he really got, that it wasn't going to happen. He'd wasted so much time thinking it's all a dream, and it should have been somebody else, and nothing lasts forever. It was time he started acting like who he was, a 19-year-old student at a secret college for real, actual magic. Now that he was in among them, he had some leisure to observe the physical kids up close. When he first met Elliot, Quentin assumed that everyone at Breakbills would be like him, but in fact, that wasn't the case at all. For one thing, even in this rarefied setting, Elliot's bizarre personal manner set him apart. For another, he was conspicuously brilliant in class, maybe not quite as quick as Alice, but Alice worked her ass off and Elliot didn't even try. Or if he did, he hid it very, very well. As far as Quentin could tell, he never studied at all. The only thing in the world that he would actually cop to caring about was his appearance, especially his expensive shirts, which he wore with cufflinks, even though it cost him regular menial punishments for violating the dress code. Josh always wore the standard school uniform, but managed to make it look like he didn't. His jacket never quite fit his wide, round build. It was always twisted or rumpled or too narrow in the shoulders. His whole personality was like an elaborate joke that he never stopped telling. It took Quentin a while to figure out that Josh expected people not to take him seriously, and he enjoyed, not always kindly, the moment when they realized too late that they'd underestimated him. Because he wasn't as self-absorbed as Elliot or Janet, he was the group's sharpest observer, and he missed very little of what went on around him. He told Quentin that he'd been waiting for Penny to snap for weeks.
"Are you kidding? That guy was a mystery wrapped in an enigma and crudely stapled to a ticking fucking time bomb. He was either going to hit somebody or start a blog. To tell you the truth, I'm kind of glad he hit you."
Unlike the other physical kids,
Josh was an undistinguished student, but once he'd mastered a skill, he was an exceptionally forceful spellcaster. It was a full 6 weeks into his first year at Breakbills before he was able to move his marble by magic, but when he finally did, as Elliot told the story, it shot through a classroom window and buried itself 6 inches in the trunk of a maple tree outside, where it probably still was. Janet's parents were lawyers of the high-flying Hollywood consorting variety and colossally wealthy. She grew up in L.A. being babysat by various celebrities whom under duress, but not very much duress, she would name. Quentin supposed that accounted for the vivid, actressy edge to her manner. She was the most visible of the physical kids, loud and brusque and always proposing toasts at dinner. She had terrible taste in men. The best that could be said of her endless series of boyfriends is that none of them lasted long. Pretty rather than beautiful, she had a flat, flapperish figure, but she used what she had to maximum advantage. She sent her uniforms back home to be tailored, and there was something vibrantly sexy about her ravenous, too-wide gaze. You wanted to meet it and be devoured by it. Janet was about as annoying as a person could be and still be your friend, but Quentin was never bored around her. She was passionately loyal, and if she was obnoxious, it was only because she was so deeply tender-hearted. It made her easily wounded, and when she was wounded, she lashed out. She tortured everybody around her, but only because she was more tortured than anyone. Even though he was part of the physical kids now, Quentin still spent most of his time with the other third years. He took his classes with them and worked with them in PA and studied for exams with them and sat with them at dinner. The maze had been scrambled and redrawn over the summer, as it was every summer, it turned out, and they spent a week's worth of afternoons relearning it, yelling at one another over the tall hedges when they got lost or found an especially sweet shortcut. They threw a party in honor of the fall equinox. There was a strong undercurrent of Wiccan sentiment at Breakbills, though hardly anybody took it seriously except the naturals. They had a bonfire and music and a wicker man and a light show by the illusionists, and everybody stayed out way too late, their noses running in the cold fall air, their faces hot and red from the fire. Alice and Quentin taught the others the fire-shaping spell, which was a big hit, and Amanda Orloff revealed that she'd been brewing a batch of mead on the sly for the past couple of months. It was sweet and fizzy and disgusting, and they all drank way too much of it and felt like death the next day. That fall, Quentin's studies changed again. There was less rote learning of gestures and arcane languages, though God knows there was plenty of that, and more actual spellcasting. They spent an entire month on low-level architectural magic, spells to strengthen foundations and rainproof roofs and keep gutters free of rotting leaves, all of which they practiced on a pathetic little shed barely larger than a doghouse. Just one spell to make a roof resistant to lightning took Quentin 3 days to memorize, grinding the gestures in a mirror to get them exactly right, at the proper speed and with the proper angles and emphasis. And then there was the incantation, which was in a corrupt old Bedouin Arabic and very tricky. And then Professor March conjured a little rainstorm, which emitted a single lightning bolt that sheared through it in one eye-searing, ego-demolishing instant, while Quentin stood there getting soaked to the skin. On alternate Tuesdays, Quentin worked with Bigby, the physical kid's unofficial faculty advisor, who turned out to be a small man with large, liquid eyes and close-cropped gray hair, who dressed neatly, if extremely affectedly, in a long, Victorian-looking duster. His posture was slightly hunched, but he didn't seem otherwise frail or crippled. Quentin had the impression that Bigby was a political refugee from somewhere. He was always making vague noises about the conspiracy that had ousted him, and what he would do following his inevitable return to power. He had the stiff, wounded dignity of the deposed intelligentsia. One afternoon, during a seminar, Bigby specialized in ridiculously difficult enchantments that transmuted elements by manipulating their structure on a quantum level. He paused and performed an odd gesture. He reached back behind first one shoulder, then the other, unbuttoning something back there. The movement reminded Quentin of nothing more than a woman unhooking her bra. When Bigby was finished, four magnificent insect wings, like a dragonfly's, two on each side, sprang out from behind him. He flexed them with a deep, satisfied sigh. The wings were gauzy and iridescent. They disappeared for a second in a buzz of activity, then reappeared as they became still.
"Sorry," he said. "Couldn't stand it a minute more."
It never stopped, the weirdness of this place. It just went on and on.
"Professor Bigby, are you a..."
Quentin stopped.
"A what? An elf? An angel?"
He was being rude, but he couldn't help it.
"Are you a fairy?"
Bigby smiled a pained smile. His wings made a dry, chitinous rattle.
"Pixie, technically," he said.
He seemed a little sensitive about it. One morning, very early, Professor March was giving a lecture on weather magic and summoning cyclonic wind patterns. For a portly man, he was surprisingly spry. Just looking at him bouncing on his toes with his red ponytail and his red face made Quentin want to go back to bed. In the mornings, Chambers served tarry black espresso, which he smelted in a delicate gilded glass exotic Turkish device, but it was all gone by the time Quentin came down for class. He closed his eyes. When he opened them again, Professor March was addressing him directly.
"Between a subtropical cyclone and an extratropical? Quentin? In the French, please, if you can."
Quentin blinked. He must have drifted off.
"The difference?" he hazarded.
"There is no difference?" There was a long, awkward pause, into which Quentin inserted more words in an attempt to find out what exactly the question had been, and to say, "Baroclinic zones," as many times as possible, just in case they were relevant. People shifted in their chairs. March, having caught the delicious scent of humiliation, was prepared to wait. Quentin waited, too. There was something in the reading about this. He'd actually done it. That was the injustice of it. The moment stretched on and on. His face was on fire. This wasn't even magic. It was meteorology.
"I don't understand,"
came a voice from the back of the classroom.
"I'm asking Quentin, Amanda."
"But maybe you could clarify something?"
It was Amanda Orloff. She persisted with the shit-eating blitheness of somebody who had academic cred to burn.
"For the rest of us? Whether these are barotropic cyclones or not, I find it a little confusing."
"They are all barotropic, Amanda," March said, exasperated. "It's irrelevant. All tropical cyclones are barotropic."
"But I thought one was barotropic and one was baroclinic,"
Alice put in. The resulting mass wrangle ended up being so inane and time-consuming that March was forced to abandon Quentin and move on or lose the entire thread of the lecture. If he could have done so unobtrusively, Quentin would have run back to where Amanda Orloff was sitting and kissed her on her broad, unmoisturized forehead. Instead, he settled for blowing her a kiss when March wasn't looking. March had segued into a lengthy spell that involved sketching an elaborate mandala-like symbol on the chalkboard. He stopped every 30 seconds and stepped back to the edge of the stage, hands on hips, whispering to himself, then dove back into the design. The point of the spell was fairly trivial. It either guaranteed hail or prevented it, one or the other. Quentin wasn't really following, and anyway, the principle was the same. Either way, Professor March was struggling with it. The spell was in a very proper and precise medieval Dutch that evidently wasn't his forte. It occurred to Quentin that it might be nice if he screwed it up. He hadn't particularly enjoyed being called out on technical minutiae this early in the morning. He would play a tiny prank. Breakbill's classrooms were proofed against most forms of mischief, but it was well known that the podium was any teacher's Achilles' heel. You couldn't do much to it, but the wards on it weren't quite ironclad, and with a lot of effort and some body English, you could get it to rock back and forth a little. Maybe that would be enough to throw Professor March, the students called him Death March, off his game. Quentin made a few small gestures under his desk, between his knees. The podium stirred as if it were stretching a kink in its back, then became inert again. Success. March was reeling off some extra old high Dutch. His attention flicked down at the podium as he felt it move, and he hesitated, but recovered his concentration and forged ahead. It was either that or start the whole spell over. Quentin was disappointed, but infallible Alice leaned over.
"Idiot," she whispered. "He dropped the second syllable. He should have said..."
Just then, for an instant, the film of reality slipped off the spokes of its projector. Everything went completely askew and then righted itself again as if nothing had happened. Except that, like a continuity error in a movie, there was now a man standing behind Professor March. He was a small man, conservatively dressed in a neat gray English suit and a maroon club tie that was fixed in place with a silver crescent moon pin. Professor March, who was still talking, didn't seem to realize he was there. The man looked out at the third years archly, conspiratorially, as if they were sharing a joke at the teacher's expense. There was something odd about the man's appearance. Quentin couldn't seem to make out his face. For a second, he couldn't figure out why, and then he realized it was because there was a small, leafy branch in front of it that partially obscured his features. The branch came from nowhere. It was attached to nothing. It just hung there in front of the man's face. Then Professor March stopped speaking and froze in place. Alice had stopped, too. The room was silent. A chair creaked. Quentin couldn't move either. There was nothing restraining him, but the line between his brain and his body had been cut. Was the man doing this? Who was he? Alice was still leaned over slightly in his direction, and a flyaway wisp of her hair hung in his field of vision. He couldn't see her eyes. The angle was wrong. Everything and everybody was still. The man on the stage was the only thing in the world still in motion. Quentin's heart started to pound. The man cocked his head and frowned as if he could hear it. Quentin didn't understand what had happened, but something had gone wrong. Adrenaline poured into his bloodstream, but it had nowhere to go. His brain was boiling in its own juices. The man began strolling around the stage, exploring his new environment. His demeanor was that of a gentleman balloonist who had accidentally touched down in exotic surroundings, inquisitive, amused. With the branch in front of his face, his intentions were impossible to read. He circled Professor March. There was something strange about the way he moved, something too fluid about his gait. When he walked into the light, Quentin saw that he wasn't quite human, or if he had been once, he wasn't anymore. Below the cuffs of his white shirt, his hands had three or four too many fingers. 15 minutes crawled by, then half an hour. Quentin couldn't turn his head, and the man moved in and out of his field of view. He puttered with Professor March's equipment. He toured the auditorium. He took out a knife and pared his fingernails. Objects stirred and shifted restlessly in place whenever he walked too near them. He picked up an iron rod from March's demonstration table and bent it like a piece of licorice. Once he cast a spell, he spoke too fast for Quentin to catch the details, that made all the dust in the room fly up and whirl crazily in the air before settling down again. It had no other obvious effect. When he cast the spell, the extra fingers on his hands bent sideways and backward. An hour passed, then another. Quentin's fear came and went, and came back in huge, sweating rushes, crashing waves. He was sure something very bad was happening, it just wasn't clear yet exactly what. He knew it had something to do with his joke on March. How could he have been so stupid? In a cowardly way, he was glad he couldn't move. It spared him from having to attempt something brave. The man seemed barely aware that he was in a room full of people. There was something grotesquely comic about him. His silence was like that of a mime. He approached a ship's clock that hung at the back of the stage and slowly put his fist through it. He didn't punch it. He forced his hand into its face, breaking the glass and snapping the hands and crushing the mechanism inside until he was satisfied that it was destroyed. It was as if he thought he would hurt it more that way. Class should have been over ages ago. Somebody on the outside must have noticed by now. Where were they? Where was Fogg? Where the hell was that paramedic nurse woman when you really needed her? He wished he knew what Alice was thinking. He wished he could have turned his head just a few degrees more before he'd been frozen so he could see her face. Amanda Orloff's voice broke the silence. She must have gotten loose somehow and was chanting a spell rhythmically and rapidly but calmly. The spell was like nothing Quentin had ever heard, an angry, powerful piece of magic full of vicious fricatives. It was offensive magic, battle magic, designed to literally rip an opponent to pieces. Quentin wondered how she'd even learned it. Just knowing a spell like that was way off limits at Breakbills, let alone casting it. But before she could finish, her voice became muffled. It went higher and higher, faster and faster, like a tape speeding up, then faded out before she could finish. The silence returned. Morning turned into afternoon in a fever dream of panic and boredom. Quentin went numb. He heard signs of activity from outside. He could see only one window, and that was out of the very corner of his eye, but something was going on out there, blocking the light. There were sounds of hammering, and, very faintly, six or seven voices chanting in unison. A tremendous, silent flash of light burst behind the door to the corridor with such force that the thick wood glowed translucent for an instant. There were rumblings as if somebody were trying to break through the floor from underneath. None of this visibly bothered the man in the gray suit. In the window, a single red leaf flapped crazily in the wind on the end of a bare branch, having hung on longer into the fall than any of its fellows. Quentin watched it. The wind flailed the leaf back and forth on the end of its stem. It seemed like the most beautiful thing he had ever seen. All he wanted to do was go on looking at it for 1 minute longer. He would give anything for that. Just one more minute with his little red leaf. He must have slipped into a trance or fallen asleep. He didn't remember. He woke up to the sound of the man on stage singing softly and high under his breath. His voice was surprisingly tender. "Bye, baby bunting. Daddy's gone a-hunting, gone to get a rabbit skin to wrap his baby bunting in." He lapsed into humming, Then, with no warning, he vanished. It happened so silently and so suddenly that at first Quentin didn't notice he was gone. In any case, his departure was upstaged by Professor March, who'd been standing on stage the entire time with his mouth open. The instant the man was gone, March crumpled forward, bonelessly, off the stage, and knocked himself cold on the hardwood floor. Quentin tried to stand up. Instead, he slid off his chair down onto the floor between the rows of seats. His arms, legs, and back were hideously cramped. There was no strength in them. Slowly, lying on the floor in a mixture of agony and relief, he stretched out his legs. Delicious bubbles of pain released in his knees, as if he were finally unbending them after a trans-hemispherical flight in coach. Tears of relief started in his eyes. It was over. The man was finally gone, and nothing terrible had happened. Alice was groaning, too. A pair of shoes, probably hers, was in his face. The whole room rocked with moans and sobs. Afterward, Quentin would learn that Fogg had mustered the entire staff almost immediately, as soon as the man had made his appearance. The school's defensive spells detected him instantly, even if they didn't keep him out. By all accounts, Fogg had made a surprisingly competent battlefield commander, calm, organized, rapid, and accurate in his assessment of the situation, skillful in his deployment of the resources at his disposal. Over the course of the morning, an entire temporary scaffold had been constructed around the outside of the tower. Professor Heckler, wearing a welder's helmet to shield his eyes, had nearly set the tower on fire with pyrotechnical attacks. Professor Sunderland had heroically attempted to phase herself through the wall, but to no avail, and anyway it wasn't clear what she would have done if she succeeded. Even Bigby made an appearance, deploying some exotic non-human witchcraft that, Quentin got the impression, had made the rest of the faculty a little uncomfortable. That evening, after dinner, after the usual announcements about clubs and events and activities had been sullenly and desultorily attended to, Dean Fogg addressed the student body to try to explain what had happened. He stood at the head of the long dining room table, looking older than usual, as the candles guttered down and the first years gloomily cleared the last of the silverware. He fussed with his cuffs and touched his temples where he was losing his thin blonde hair. "It will not come as a surprise to many of you that there are other worlds besides our own," he began. "This is not conjecture, it is fact. I have never been to these worlds, and you will never go there. The art of passing between worlds is an area of magic about which very little is known, but we do know that some of these worlds are inhabited. Probably the beast we met today was physically quite vast." The beast was what Fogg called the thing in the gray suit, and afterward nobody ever referred to it any other way. "What we saw would have been a small part of it, an extremity it chose to push into our sphere of being, like a toddler groping around in a tide pool. Such phenomena have been observed before. They are known in the literature as excrescences. Its motivations are difficult to guess." He sighed heavily. "To such beings, we look like swimmers paddling timidly across the surface of their world, silhouetted against the light from above, sometimes diving a little below the surface, but never going very deep. Ordinarily, they pay no attention to us. Unfortunately, something about Professor March's incantation today caught the beast's attention. I understand it may have been corrupted or interrupted in some way. That error offered the beast an opportunity to enter our world." At this, Quentin convulsed inwardly, but kept his face composed. It had been him. He had done it. Fogg went on. "The beast spiraled up out of the depths like a deep-water shark intent on seizing a swimmer from below.
Its motivations are impossible to imagine, but it did appear as if it was looking for something or someone. I do not know whether it found what it was looking for.